Writers, you may think you know Serena Bowen, but have you seen her in action? Do you get her emails, every one of which is a tight little package of joy custom made for her readers? Or follow her on Instagram or TikTok as @SerenaBowen, where you can watch her show up with even more perfect little morsels of marketing and will almost certainly end up finding a book that you'll love. If you don't, you should. Get all the links at serenabowen.com. Go ahead, we'll wait.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, this is Jess Leahy, and welcome to the hashtag AmWriting podcast, the podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, proposals, queries, doing the editing, all the stuff. Sometimes we talk marketing and promotion and speaking. Today, however, we have a super fun episode about book contracts. As I said, I am Jess Leahy. I am the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation, and you can find my work at The Atlantic, at The New York Times, and at The Washington Post, and a few other places out there that I'm sure it's snuck in.
And I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of many novels, and therefore many of these really glamorous and sexy contracts. Please note the irony here, because it isn't the sexiest topic we've ever picked, but it's so important.
Well, this has come up over and over again, that like, you're such our go-to business person. Like, when I'm thinking about some creative idea that may or may not work, and I'm like, what do you think about this thing? And you're like, okay, what is your return on investment going to be for that? And you, because you also not only have a degree in economics, but you also, because you tend to create a lot of your, and you have published a lot of your own work independently, but you have also worked with traditional publishers, you have so much experience around this stuff. And so I'm actually, it may not sound exciting to everyone, but I am really excited to hear your take on what people should be looking for. I have my contracts from HarperCollins for both The Addiction Inoculation and The Gift of Failure sitting in front of me just for fun. And but you're going to lead us through most of this, and I am going to be your tutee today.
Oh, well, okay. So I have made us a little outline of what I think are the most important items in an author contract. But I would like
are
to
we,
start.
Are we going to be sharing this outline, Miss Serena Bowen, with our listeners?
Well, it might not be interesting enough to share as written, but we will have valuable info in the show notes either way.
Absolutely.
And the first valuable thing that will show up in those show notes is a link to the Authors Guild's sample contract, which is not just a sample. Like, a sample sounds like, here, you want to try a sample? But in this case, the lawyers who run the Authors Guild have spent a fair amount of time creating what they think an author contract should really look like. So that's really valuable information. If you have no other help, well, if you're an Authors Guild member, you can actually go through their legal portal and say, hey, you want to evaluate my contract? And they will say, yes, we will, for free, because that is an author benefit. Or you can go and look at their version and just see what it says. There are lots of people who could help you with this, though. Some people have an IP lawyer look at it, but you can't have like a real estate lawyer look at it, right?
Well, let's back up for 1 second, because so we're coming at that this from the, you don't have an agent who's vetting this for you first. So there are a couple different ways this can happen, right? Like, I didn't have to worry too much over the details of my contract with HarperCollins because my agent, Lori Abkemeyer, did a beautiful job at this. It actually takes months and months. You would think that since this is their business and they write these contracts all the time, that it would be a really quick turnaround thing. But there's some hemming and hawing over details that your agent might do. But so are we coming at this from the the perspective of someone who may not have an agent or wants to also shore up whatever that agent might know or not know, you know, with their own sort of information.
Okay, both. So first of all, I feel like in these modern times, lots of people don't have the representation that you and I enjoy. Most big agencies have what they call their boilerplate terms. So it's pre-negotiated. And those boilerplate terms can actually be specific from agency to agency. And they're not typically shared. So one agency may be powerful enough that they always get no AI and cover approval or whatever. I'm just picking some terms at random. And another agency might not have that firepower. And so that's one thing to be aware of. And then there's a lot of people out there negotiating with small presses who, you know, just don't have powerhouse agents because they don't work in a corner of the industry that is as well represented, let's just say.
So academic publishers come to mind for me immediately on that one. I don't know a lot of academic writers who have representation.
Agents, right. And that's actually a real problem because there's one part of an academic contract typically that is terrible. So, well, let's dive into okay. What's in our contracts and we'll say what that is because it's coming up soon. So the first point we need to make, that it's something that you and I have internalized, but not everybody has, which is that when you sell your book, you are not actually selling it. It still belongs to you. It's still your work, and your name is going to appear on the copyright page unless, you know, ominous drumroll, you are with an academic publisher, and there are a lot of them that will not give you your copyright. And that is a problem that is beyond the scope of this conversation, but it is something to be aware of. So unless you are selling your book to a very prestigious academic publishing company, the first thing to note is the copyright language in your contract. It should say you are the copyright holder. You are not selling your book. You are merely licensing it to a publisher. You are giving them the right to publish on your behalf. And that is pretty much the whole point of this contract, is to establish the boundaries of which rights you're giving and which ones you're keeping.
I love that as a starting place because you have managed to create some really inventive, permutations of this, where you keep some stuff and give away other stuff. And it's opened my eyes to some of the possibilities.
Yeah. And so the biggest possibilities, the biggest items on that bullet list are going to be included in the big kahuna publishing clause in your contract, which is the grant of rights. I would also like to stipulate that I am not a lawyer and I am not your lawyer. So this call with Jess and I is really a starting place for you to dig into the points of your contract that might be confusing to you. This is two authors bumbling through the world of publishing, but we have bumbled well.
So, well, and keep in mind, there's no shame in feeling like you need help with this. I went to law school. KJ went to law school, and yet we would never negotiate. I mean, we are lucky enough to have agents, and we are sort of can sometimes be lost in this language too. So this is not like I'm so dumb, I need to get help. This is like, if you are an author and you're entering into a contract with someone, you should have some help with it.
Right. So the grant of rights should have some fairly straightforward things in it. One is, how long are you granting these rights? Many of my international translation licensing deals have term limits that are fairly short. Like, I have some 5-year ones, I have some 7s, I have some 10 years. Most of my audio contracts also have reasonable time limits on them like this. But with a big 5 publisher, it's not unusual to see that term be written as the length of the copyright itself.
And what is that, Miss Serena Bowen?
Well, that is determined by copyright law. So it's kind of a movable feast, but it's basically your life. And depending on whether you are putting your legal name or a pseudonym on there. There's even an extension past that. So not my area of expertise, but it is a really long time.
There are plenty of some of the big authors that you might think of that have sold a bajillion books. Their estate actually can continue to hold rights in books and stuff like that. So sometimes it's like your lifetime plus another lifetime, your lifetime plus 50 years. There's a whole bunch of different permutations of these.
There are. So after term length, it's also really important to note which territories you're licensing in. And these tend to fall under some standard arrangements. For example, world rights means you've sold the book in publishing terms, like for books and ebooks and audio, all over the world in any language. So that means that your publisher would hold translation rights, and in some cases they would license these on your behalf. So you enter into a publishing agreement with World Rights. At some point, your publisher pops up and says, hey, we're going to license German rights to these people. And you will say yes and thank you. And then your contract will contain information in it about what portion of those translation rights you deserve in your paycheck. The rights that I have lately typically sold that my own agent offers are North American rights, which include the US and Canada primarily. Sometimes, for reasons I will never understand, also includes the Philippines. So that means that if somebody in the UK or Australia or Ireland or New Zealand or any other country that is a primarily English-speaking country wants to buy my book, I have to instead license it to a publisher who has the rights in those territories. And then the third major big one is World English, which makes sense for reasons that should be obvious if you just listen to that confusing bit that I just told you about how territories work. So World English would mean you're licensing in English to your publisher for the whole world, but translations are off the table in that contract. So what have you seen with this, Jess? Do you have any World English or do you have North American?
I have North American. Short Books is my UK publisher. And yeah, so that's how that went with Gift of Failure, The Addiction Inoculation. There's World English. And then there's a separate Spanish translation that Harper also handled, but in a separate transaction.
So if Harper handled
I'm pretty sure. I'm looking right now.
Oh, right. I feel like you guys negotiated that as an addendum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So this is pretty much how it works on my end of things, too. I did ask my agent this year why we don't just do World English. Like, I was asking in the spirit of, wouldn't it just be simpler? And she said, the problem with doing that is that publishers are not equally incentivized in every territory. That it's really hard for like the marketing department in New York to tell their UK friends that, hey, this book's going to be bigger. You know, there's just like a loss of control in terms of prioritization that happens. So
Hold on, yeah. There's something really weird. I just looked at both of my contracts. They're both World English, and yet I do have a separate UK publisher who did a whole separate version of it.
Ah, so if you sold
of Gift of
World
Failure.
English to mm-hmm. Harper, then mm-hmm. They must have licensed it to that UK yep. publisher for the very yep. reason that I was just saying, probably, which is yep. one of focus and, you know, and control.
It also had to do with the fact that since so much of Gift of Failure was about education, and they have a slightly different education system in terms of like what they call things. They don't really have middle school in the same way that we do. So there was some changes that needed to be made. In fact, my UK version had so many changes to it. I couldn't believe it. So yeah, there were some big changes just from an educational perspective and terminology perspective.
Well, that makes sense. Let's see. So once we get past territories, Also, I mentioned just in passing format, but it's actually very important. 25 years ago, if you had a publishing contract, there would be no mention of ebooks in it because those were not a thing. So, because that was a major shift in publishing, now contracts tend to be a lot smarter about this. And your contract might say something like, you're licensing print, you're licensing ebook, and you are or aren't licensing audio. But then there might be a clause that says which things you are not licensing. For purposes of clarity, the following still belongs to the author. Film.
Yeah, those are called gaming. Retained rights.
Right. So right. Retained rights can typically look like film, dramatic performance.
Graphic novel,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And also, sometimes there's a fun little clause in there that's like, and formats not known at this moment, you know, yep. Just to prevent the whole ebook pileup of misunderstanding that happened previously.
Also, interestingly, even though it doesn't really apply to my books, I did retain the right to publish prequels and sequels to the work.
Okay. So that's interesting because to me that a prequel might get a little funky with the non-compete stuff. But yeah, that's cool. We've just touched the very big things, but they're often the things that matter the most. And so you also need to consider that you know exactly who owns the translation rights when you sign a contract. Because if you're lucky and your book catches on, you need to know who is in charge of that, who has the ability to make those rights pay off.
So, Serena, let's say, for example, you're Jess Leahy and you get an email from someone who really likes your English language version and happens to be fluent in another language. It's their native language. And they're like, please, I would love to translate for this for you. Do I have the right to sell my book off to someone who emails me and says, I would really like to make this into, Lithuanian?
Well, you might and you might not, but you have to check. And of course, yeah, that's always wild. I have found outrageous bootleg translations of my books on the internet with like art and, oh, it's just the first time it was a really bad day when I found this entire, production of the book into another language with background art in a hockey theme, and
the answer for me is those always go to my agent, and the answer is always going to be that, my agent has handled the main contract for this book with HarperCollins, but then there are these people called sub rights agents, and those people handle, other languages and stuff like that. And so there are people who actually handle that for you. So no matter how excited you are about that email to get your book translated into another language, you should definitely, if you have representation, definitely forward that along to your agent.
Yep. So then the next big category of things that end up being discussed are, how are you getting paid? And usually that breaks down into an advance, which we'd very much like to see in every single contract, because the more skin in the game your publisher has, the harder they're going to work on it. So you want to see an advance there.
And it might be in pieces, in which case then they're going to outline, if it's one chunk or two chunks or three chunks or four chunks, or if you're super lucky, five chunks, and how those chunks are going to go out and when.
I have never seen five, but I do have four chunk contracts, and it is broken down like this. 25% on signing of the contract. 25% on an accepted manuscript. And that is something that people tend not to explain, which means after you've edited the book with your editor and they say, okay, it's ready to be sent on to the copy editor, which is a late stage edit, and then it's an accepted manuscript. So if you're counting on this cash to pay your bills, you have to have a good grip on when that is. Chunk number three of four is often on publication. And chunk number 4 of 4 is, in my case, 1 year after publication. How did you get five chunks?
One is on execution of the agreement or contract. Number 2 is on acceptance of the manuscript, as you said. Number 3 is on initial publication. Number 4 is 12 months following initial publication, and that happens to usually coincide with the paperback coming out. And then number 5 is usually around 18 months following the initial publication, so usually 6 months after the paperback comes out.
Huh. Okay. So I did have an author friend quiz me on this, and she was astonished to find this in her contract. And she really was like upset about it. And I said to her, look, I don't get upset about this because personally, I like to not pay taxes on the whole thing all at once. So if you trust that that publisher is going to still be around 2 years from now or 3 years from now when that last chunk is due to you, then, and you don't need the cash to live, because of course that was the first question I asked her, then this isn't a bad thing. Like I don't find this to be the most reprehensible part of my contracts, honestly, but you have to be prepared to see it because, yeah.
It does help you to plan ahead for your, you know, I pay quarterly taxes, estimated taxes and all that kind of stuff. And it does allow you to sort of plan ahead with your, you know, with your taxes for what you're going to be expecting.
Right. I have the same. I have like a little breakdown in my annual planner that's like, here's what I think I'm getting this year in advance money. And, you know, and it sort of goes out into 2027 or 2028. And then in places where amounts are small, you will tend to see one or two chunks. Like when I have a foreign rights deal, it's often two chunks. It's upon signing, and then the second half is upon publication. But if it's in a country sort of far removed from the Western experience, it tends to all show up in one lump. And it's partly because of the currency risk that that publisher faces. Like they know where the dollar to Thai baht is today. And sometimes it makes sense for them to just pay it instead of owing you dollars on a forward basis. And they don't know where the dollar will be. So that's why that happens.
Okay. So what's up next? This may have to be a two-parter, by the way. There's a lot to talk about here. We'll have to see.
We're getting there though.
Okay. All right.
We're really closing in. So okay. Part 4 is manuscript delivery and acceptance, which means a timeline for you to see, you know, when are things due and what happens when people are unhappy. So it should contain the due date of your manuscript if you haven't written it yet. And it should specify, it might specify some editorial timeline stuff. And like, for example, if they edit your book and then they expect edits from you and you don't turn them in a timely fashion, or they don't like what you've edited, and what happens if this romance breaks up, basically?
If you're writing nonfiction, since this podcast is all about flattening learning curves and learning from mistakes that have been made by, oh, I don't know, me, how about I just give you a little advice here that if you sell your book, your research-oriented book, and it is your first book that you're writing, do not commit, if you're selling in April, to a November 1st handed in date. That's not enough time. I did that. I was confident I could do that. And I did it. In fact, I was in a couple days early, but it was harrowing. But we have also coached someone else on here, Emily Edlin, a while back. She had a year to finish everything while finishing something else. And we talked her through it. It can be done, but it's just give yourself a little bit of grace. Don't like be all optimistic. At least try to be realistic in your time and how much work it's going to take to finish your book.
Yep. And really, if you are presented with a contract, read that stuff carefully, because it's important. You know, a publisher can turn you down after the contract is signed if you don't perform the way that they've expected to. And you could, under some circumstances, owe the advance back if you don't, you know. So you need to be aware of everything that's in there. And then my last chunk here was other clauses that can affect your life that you might find in your publishing contract, like how will the copyright read? That should absolutely be in there. Then there's something called the option clause. And an option clause usually gives your publisher the first shot at the following book. I mean, if you have a 2-book deal, then the option clause would refer to book 3. And it will say something like, they get the first look and they have 30, 60, or 90 days to respond. And it will also usually say something like, they get to offer terms first and you can't accept somebody else's offer before you deal with them. But it almost never says you can't publish that book somewhere else. Like, if you and your publisher do not enjoy a smooth relationship, there is almost no option clause in the world whereby you can't sell another book to somebody else. Like, you can turn down their offer and then go seek another one. But of course, that's a really difficult thing to do. It's hard to say no to an offer from a publisher you've worked with before, and they know that. And I don't know, option clauses, they definitely favor the publisher and not the author, but it's not hard to say why.
My option clause, interestingly, since I write nonfiction, my first two books were nonfiction. If I wrote fiction, Harper would not have an option. It's only on my next nonfiction. Yeah.
That's a really good point. All of my option clauses are limited to. And because I have two publishers at the moment in fiction, they're limited. Like, the option clause says work of domestic suspense. Like, it's all the way tightened down to the subgenre for this very reason, because I couldn't have signed a contract that didn't permit me to write other kinds of fiction, because that just isn't going to work out. So
I have a question, actually, and I don't know that I've ever asked you this question before, but let's say, for example, you are loving some characters from one of your series and you want to write about those characters, but maybe not necessarily with that same publisher. Are you allowed to write about a universe or characters that has previously been published by your traditional publishers, for a different publisher or for yourself independently?
Well, again, not a lawyer, but the answer to that question is probably. And it would go like this. Like, if I'm doing a series with one publisher and they decide not to do book 4, then I know I could publish book 4 because there's nothing in my contracts that ever talks about characters.
Right, of course.
But they could. Like, mm-hmm. That is a thing that could show up in a contract, but I have never seen it. So if they have turned down book 4, then there is nothing stopping me from publishing book 4. There are clauses in all of my contracts about competition. Mm-hmm. It's a non-compete clause, which simply says, well, it's not so simple, but it says something like, you can't publish a competing work. And I have always found this clause to be really slippery, and it's a good thing I've never had to lean too hard on it. But, you know, that is definitely a question for your agent. Like,
it's really, mine's pretty fascinating, because my non-compete is, I can't publish a competing work, a work that would compete, for example, with Gift of Failure, either before Gift of Failure came out or for 2 years after Gift of Failure came out. So if I wanted to put something else out there that was Gift of Failure content, I can't do that without their involvement up to 2 years after that.
Right. We should also mention there, I have seen, but not lately, something called the next publish work clause, mm-hmm. which for new authors is fairly standard. It would say something like, and the work in this contract, the work that we're contracting here will be the publisher's next published work, which is not a clause that I can live with at this point in my career either, because I have a couple of contracts ongoing. So I could not have a next published work contract. In fact, I had to strike it from a contract a few years ago where it clearly didn't belong. And the publisher sort of apologized, like, we didn't mean to put that in there. Because that wasn't going to work out for me. Now, you might see some lines in your contract about cover consideration.
I was actually just about to bring that up. In mine, it comes up under, quote, special provisions. And there's a couple of really interesting things in there. And the reason I wanted to talk about it is that I did an event this last week. And I had Mandarin copies with me because there were a lot of people at this particular event who spoke Mandarin. And so I wanted to have a book available for them if they wanted it. But I never know. I don't know what my book's called because it could be called something completely different because of the translation. I don't have any way of judging the quality of the translation. So it was really fun going through it with a native Mandarin speaker at this last event and sort of looking through it. And he seemed very surprised when I told him that I didn't know what the book was actually called, like what the title translates as. You really, when it comes to the international, like subright stuff, don't have much or any control really over anything, the title, the translation, what the cover art will look like. However, in my contract with Harper, and it was a really wonderful, this happened to be a really great part of working with Harper, is my contract says that we shall mutually agree upon the final title and subtitle. That was great. And the publisher shall consult the author regarding the cover, jacket design and copy, interior design and catalog copy of the physical versions of the work. And that really was, if I had had big feelings about a particular font or, you know, little details, like there's a little broken pencil at the heading of each chapter, and we came up with that. And so that was really a lovely part of working with them. I can't speak for everyone's experience, but that's in my special provisions.
Yeah, except I have always thought that this is the squishiest.
It is incredibly squishy. Yeah.
Like they're probably not enforceable at all. Like it's not like I don't want them in there, because of course I do, but like consulted is, I don't know.
Right.
So there are some of my foreign publishers that I swear to God will email my agent who forwards to me, that's like, here's the cover for this book. Could you get back to us by the end of today? And then
I've had international versions go out and I never saw them before they got published.
Right. But like, thanks for the heads up. Because then the first thing I do is I look at Amazon and usually I see the cover already anyway. It's just like, thanks, guys. Thanks for the consultation. But yeah, so that's fun. But so these are some squishy clauses that just, you know, some things in your contract are going to be very delineated, like how many dollars is how many dollars, and we're not going to be able to argue about that. You know what we didn't cover though, Jess?
We didn't cover royalty. I know, and I was just about to say, I think because there are enough interesting clauses around royalties, do you want to try to cover it here? I'm happy to do it. I'm looking at mine right now. Okay, let's do it, because I just saw something interesting and juicy.
Can you quiz me about standards though? Because this is, I think I've got them memorized by this late moment in my career.
Serena, if you can, tell us, and this is for all the money in the bank, tell us, for the win, what the standard clauses for royalties are.
Okay, hardcover usually starts at 10%. Okay. Usually has an escalator, which means that after you sell 10,000 copies, you get some number better than 10%. And hardcover, all print royalties are based on the cover price of your book. So if you have a $30 hardcover and you are a 10%er for your royalty, that's $3 a book, and we can still read our royalty statements because we understand this. How'd I do?
Great. It says, on regular sales, these percentages of suggested retail price, SRP, is where you're getting these percentages. Yes.
Right. Okay. Now, paperbacks get a little weirder. So trade paperback, which is the ones that you see most all the time. It's like 5 1/4 by 8 or 5 1/2 by 8 1/2 or sometimes 6 by 9. Those books only pay a 7.5% royalty usually.
Perfect.
Oh, good. Jess gave me the thumbs up. And mass market paperbacks, which are the ones that fit on a rack that are slowly dying a death, like they're hardly in the world anymore, are 8%.
Yes, that is correct. Woo-hoo, I have an escalator on that one.
Do you? Nice. I was told that escalators on trade paperback are very uncommon these days.
I do not have an escalator on trade or paper or hard, actually.
Oh, okay. So moving on, we have to mention ebooks here and audio because
actually,
they both
I will very quickly mention my percentage on large print hardcover is 10% and my percentage on large print paperback, which is another thing that's out there, is 7.5%.
Okie dokie. Digital. Let's go. So digital tends to have this same royalty in your contract, like your what you get for audio and ebooks tend to be the same. But here's the kicker. It is based on net, not cover price.
And net can be expressed as amounts received.
Yes. Mine say amounts received in at least one of my contracts. Yeah. But here's what we need to point out to you about amounts received. Let's say your ebook costs $10 because that's such a nice round number. It's probable that your publisher, whoever they are, is getting 70% as their take on an ebook, which means they price it at 10 bucks, they take in seven, those $3 stay with whoever the ebook was purchased from, people like Amazon Kindle or Apple Books or Kobo. And then, so your 25% would be based off of a number close to $7.
Yep.
Yeah. So you can almost figure out what your per unit royalty rate. Oh, and your royalty rate is probably 25%. That is absolutely the most common number to see in a royalty rate for digital.
And then there's the maze of things like the early reads or the first reads or the what are those special, like you pay this amount, you get unlimited, Amazon Unlimited or Kindle Unlimited or whatever. There's a whole separate morass when it comes to like Kindle Unlimited.
It is a morass. And in my experience, learning what your publisher gets on those is like nearly impossible.
Nice.
And it's not because like they could tell you, but they'd have to kill you. It's really because every one of those pays a little bit differently and your editor doesn't know. Like find me a big editor at a New York house who knows how much Hoopla pays versus Kindle Unlimited versus pay per borrow at Overdrive. Like none of them do. And that's because it's not their main job. So yeah, that stuff gets a little messy, but you should be getting 25% of whatever they got.
Okay. Is that for it for royalties? Or do you have anything to add? Because I have a nonfiction thing to add. Okay.
Okay. Go.
So for a nonfiction book, you also have a section of your contract that has to do with licensed versions. And this has to do with rights payments for like first serial. So for example, let's say The Gift of Failure comes out and a whole bunch of different publications would like to put something to, would like to publish something about it. And first serial is like the juicy one. Like let's say for me, I'm probably going to want to get my first serial with the New York Times. So I'm going to, so that means they have first access to an excerpt of my book. And the nice thing about first serial is, you know, you really want to give whoever's going to get first serial, if you're lucky enough to get it, something really juicy, something that will really make people want to read the book. The way first serial works is that the, so how do I explain this? The first serial, I would get 90% of the amounts received for a first serial, which doesn't tend to be very much, but still. And then English language outside the U.S., 80%. So whatever the New York Times is going to pay for getting that first serial right, I would get 90% of that. And that's why, and this is the reason I bring it up, is that is why you have to work with your publisher on where those excerpts are going to go. Because you could fight over them. They could say, oh, no, we want it in this publication. You could say, I want it in this publication. And I had an issue with one of my books where one publication sort of thought they were getting first serial, but they weren't. We never used that terminology. And then they were mad. And then another person got it. But make sure you work with your publisher, with your publicist specifically, about who's getting your first serial rights. It's a big deal with nonfiction. Like, you know, people will toss this around and say, oh, who has first serial rights on that? And it's sort of a statement of the how excited people seem to be, the publications seem to be about your book coming out. it's a thing.
Awesome. So, okay, lightning round on a few more things. You were right. Yeah. This did turn into a long episode, but this is all quality. Okay.
Yeah.
So you might see a clause about indemnification where you are indemnifying your publisher against sins you've committed. So if you are libeling the entire world in your manuscript, or if you stole the book from somebody else or some terrible thing like that, your publisher does not have to take the hit for that. Although publishers are fairly savvy around libel and will have their own legal teams work on that. So
some authors I know literally have gone through the book with a fine-tooth comb, but that would be dumb because why would you comb a book? But have had lawyers from the publisher, especially if you're writing about someone famous, if you're writing like a biography of, you know, some famous, very famous person, the lawyers are going to go over every word of that book.
Right. Okay. Next lightning round thing is reserves against returns.
What does that mean, Serena?
Well, that just means they can hold some of your royalties back if they think that the book's paperbacks are going to be returned to them and they aren't going to sell them. And honestly, we shouldn't go over that here because it's a small thing in the lives of a, you know, war horse author. Reversion terms. So there should be a part of your contract that states how you get the rights back if stuff goes wrong, meaning if somebody goes bankrupt or if the publisher is sold to someone else, or...
And we know people that this has happened to. It was even for a series, like book one and book two came out from one publisher and then the publisher went kablooey.
Yeah. So you should have a clause that says, hey, if this stuff hits the fan, you get your rights back and you can do whatever you want with your book. Also, failure to pay should be in there. And out of print, if your book is out of print. And there should be a fantastic clause that explains what out of print means that does not just refer to the ebook.
And it also will include your ability to purchase back copies. For example, if it goes out of print or if they're going to remainder books, then often there's a little thing in there saying you can buy these back at a certain discounted price.
Yeah, I don't have that in most of mine, but okay. So now a couple of red flags. We're going to leave you with a couple of red flags, things that you do not want to see in your contract. One of them is film rights. Even if it says non-exclusive. And this is something I've seen in so many dodgy contracts lately.
What she means by this is you do want to see a mention of film rights, but you do not want to see that one of the things you're giving away is film rights. Correct?
Right. It could be under retained.
Yeah. Right.
Or you can have a really crystalline, clear contract about what rights you are granting. Like, it's okay to have a contract that doesn't mention film rights, but you should never see film rights under... things that you're granting, even if they say non-exclusive, because that is a bullshit clause. If you are ever so lucky to sell film rights on a book, you have to be able to deliver exclusive film rights to the film producer. So none of this non-exclusive crap, because that's worse than nothing.
That's different in journalism, by the way. Usually the publication retains, like, they can do whatever that, like the New York Times has sort of been known for this, is that if there was a movie based on something I wrote in my column that I wrote for them, the parent teacher conference, then they own it. They own all the stuff.
Okay. Well, derivative works are another big red flag in a book publishing contract. You don't want to see them have the ability to do derivative works, because that means they could sell off the idea to some other authors and just, you know, continue your series forever and ever without your help. No, thank you. And also, you don't want to see the lack of reversion language, but I think we covered that. And Jess, I got to say, we made it to the bottom of this big outline.
We did. There are rights of termination, but you kind of mentioned that. And I think, like, if the publisher fails to publish it and stuff like that, all those sorts of things. And the nice thing at the end of the contract, there's often like a little glossary, like what acceptance means, what combined work means, because you don't want to just see the word acceptance with no explanation of what on earth acceptance means. So make sure that that is clearly explained as well, because when it comes to law, you do not want a very open interpretation of a term.
Right. And if you don't get a nice glossary, you need to find someone to ask, and you cannot be afraid to ask. Like, if a publisher wants your book, they are not going to yank that contract out of your hands because you asked a question about what something means. Like,
because they already have a document sitting somewhere that is a glossary. They just do.
Yeah. Yeah. And try not to be afraid. It's so easy to say that and so hard to do, but you don't have to. You don't have to be like Oliver Twist, who's like, please, sir, may I have some more? Like, this is your big moment to get all your stuff clarified before you sign. So make sure you use it.
Yep. I love it. This is great. You did really, really well. You passed the lightning rounds. I'm going to have to come up with like a prize for you to go away with, and I'll come up with something. But you did very well. We have hopefully flattened the learning curve for some of you out there. Can we close with where we started, which is if you have any questions and you're working on your own and you're not represented, please, please consider, if you're able to join the Authors Guild. It is a ridiculous, amazing resource that will have your back. And we cannot say enough good things about them. So please go see the Authors Guild, because there are actually some things you can access there, even if you're not a member. But if you're a member, that's the best. It's the best thing in the world for an author. So, yep. All right. I guess that's it. And I now have gone back through my contract, which is something I didn't know that I would ever do. So great. All right, everyone. You can continue to listen as a free listener. You could subscribe, and you're going to get extra stuff if you subscribe and you come up as a sponsor. And you can find all of the AmWriting stuff at amwriting.substack.com. And we love you, and we're so grateful that you continue to listen. And until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output, because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.